caviar.com. Treat yourself to a tasting at home. Introducing Petite Caviar 101. Caviar, truffles, and more. Find the world's best caviar for over 30 years. Sustainable caviar, seasonal delights, boutique grocery, family-owned and operated. Proud to supply the highest quality caviar available for over 30 years. 100% sustainable caviar. Israeli Oyster, Belgian Oyster, Idaho White Sturgeon, Siberian Sturgeon, Paddlefish, Ikira. National overnight shipping, guaranteed national next day overnight shipping, Tuesday through Saturday. Same day, local pickup and curbside for Seattle, ready within 2 hours, Monday through Saturday. Next day local delivery, guaranteed next day local delivery for Seattle, Monday through Friday. Shop grocery for such items like Bellwether Farms Cream Fresh, Betsy's Blink, gluten-free Betsy's Blink, Black Truffle Butter, White Truffle Oil, La Brujula, Yellowfin Fina Belly in Olive Oil, Russell's Original Spice Blend, Truffle Salt, Holsteinware's Mother of Pearl Caviar Spoon, Mother of Pearl Spoon with Blue Handle, Great Barrier Reef Petite Spoon with Pointed Tip, Round Mother of Pearl Pellet, Caviar Presentoir with Sterling Band, Petite Mother of Pearl Caviar Spoon, St. Hilaire Modern Caviar Presentoir, Frusis Saturn Silver Plated Caviar Cup, Homemade Recipes and More, Mink Potato Roasty with Caviar and Cream Fresh, Devil Quail Eggs with Caviar, Blink with Buckwheat. Hope you had a good week. Here is chapter 23 of American Dirt by Janine Cummins. All that's left of Lydia and Sebastian's life savings is the paltry sum El Comandante returned to Lydia's wallet after he collected the price for her and Luca. It's a total of 4,941 pesos, or around $243. In regular life, that kind of money is substantial. It would buy many weeks' worth of groceries. It would go toward rent or doctor's bills or putting gas on the Beetle, but now the amount feels negligible. They have nothing. If they go to El Norte, they will have to start from scratch. Already they need new shoes. Lucas are beginning to run thin in the soles. Abuela's gold lame sneakers are peeling apart at the toe. The $243 minus some new shoes is not enough. Lydia feels destitute, but thank God they will have her mother's money in the bank. Enough to pay a coyote to help them cross. That's all she can think about for now. When at last the guard opens the door and they tag her out of captivity, Lydia's not thinking about the money anyway. The guard stays in her mind, his searching expression, his groping for the memory of her face. She knows he's back there still, that he could remember her at any moment. Yes, Dios mío, that's her, the one who belongs to Los Jardineros. They run. They don't know where they are, how far they are from the train or the city. They've emerged from a large warehouse in a rural landscape, and they don't hear any distant rumble of locomotive or car engine. They run toward the leftover glow in the sky, pink fading to purple where the sun recently descended, due west over this uneven ground, through rounds and ditches and holes burrowed by unseen animals across rocks and roots and twisted clumps of plant life, hoping to intercept the road that runs from south to north. The pain in Lydia's ankle asserts itself only when she flexes her foot, so she tries to keep it straight. Both girls limp too, but Soledad is like a ball of fire, and she batters herself against the pain while she runs. Luca encourages all of them like a breathless cheerleader as they go. Come on, Rebecca, you can do it. Keep up, Mamie, let's go. Soledad pushes ahead. She would run all the way to El Norte. When they come to a road, they pause. No cars in sight. The twilight still pink around them. Soledad steps close to Lydia. She reaches for Lydia's hand. Thank you, she trembles. Lydia's beset by guilt. She's been ready to leave them there. It was Luca, she says. Soledad grabs the top of Luca's hair. She bends down and looks into his face. You saved their lives, you know that. You and your Mamie. She doesn't let go of Lydia's hand. Luca smiles. Rebecca begins to cry, a tight, high-pitched sound that startles him. Her face is a twisted distress and her breath crashes out of her between sharp hums. Her jeans are covered in the dead man's blood mixed with some of her own. In the button has been ripped off the fly so they no longer stay on. Lydia retrieves one of the belts from her backpack and laces it through the girl's belt loop. Loops where her wrecker winces and shakes, but endures Lydia's kindness. She fastens the belt to herself. Solda stands behind and twists her sister's black hair into a ponytail, revealing a dark purple bruise on her neck. She touches the spot softly with her finger. Rebecca turns to her and the girls embrace. Rebecca shudders and cries, and they all wait close together until she's able to walk again. She folds her arms in front of her because her bra is gone. They turn north to follow the road, and the light fades from purple to indigo to blue, and by the time they pass the outskirts of a village, they're walking in darkness. Lydia watches over her shoulder the whole time, waiting for the approach of a distant light, a distant gunshot. Her exhaustion is so much for her fear, and she keeps pushing ahead as quickly as they can go. They're all very thirsty because they finished whatever water they had with them hours ago, and there's no shop here, no river or stream. It seems too dangerous to venture into the tiny village, but not yet far enough away from the warehouse. Those men, they don't want to reveal themselves, but they haven't eaten today and they are hungry. Despite their adrenaline, they weaken as they go. Occasionally, the headlights of a car approach and they dart away from the road to hold still against whatever cover they can find. They know without speaking that this new fear is a burden they're all carrying together. This sense that they haven't really escaped, that they're not safe. Any one of those cars could be carrying the men who abducted them earlier. Those men, without the knowledge of their commandante, may decide to come after them to repeat and repeat and repeat the things they did to Rebecca and Soldat in the back of their truck earlier. They may decide to drag Lydia to the trunk of the car by her hair, to rip liquor from her arm, to shoot him on the side of the road, and then drive her through the night back to Acapulco to Javier. He's waiting for her there. At length, they begin to sense the ragged glow of a town to the north. They pass a juncture and the traffic becomes steadier. They can no longer flee from the road each time a car passes because there are too many. We'll get water, Lydia says. Soon there'll be a place. Someone will give us water. There is no real indication of how true this might be, but she says it because she needs it, and it's encouragement enough for the others to quicken their pace. The land is flat and the lights of the town soon come into view. The car passes them, slows down ahead, pulls onto the shoulder, and stops. Lydia puts out a hand to stop Luca from walking any farther. Rebecca and Soledad both freeze. They draw their bodies close together. The car reverses some way toward them, and the girls run from the road, but there's nowhere for them to go. Lydia stands her ground. She leans down automatically to retrieve her machete from its holster, forgetting that it's gone now. She curses mildly under her breath, $243 minus two pairs of shoes and a new machete. She puts Luca behind her. The door on the driver's side opens and the man steps out. He's wearing cowboy boots, jeans, a button-up shirt. He stays beside his car but doesn't attempt to approach them. Are you okay? He calls to the doctors. Fine, Lydia answers. Migrants? Lydia did not respond. We see many migrants on this road at night, some in very poor condition, and the man explains, and no one knows where they're coming from. You're well off the migrant trail here. How did you come to be in this neighborhood? Lydia tightens her lips. He continues talking, undeterred by their reticence to speak to him. I'm a doctor, he says. I have a clinic not far. If you want, I can take you to safety. Soldat stops, but Rebecca squeezes her arm. It's not funny. Soldat starts to fall on hysterics. Is something wrong? The man asks. Safety. Soldat howls with laughter. Luca presses in beside his mamie. Why is she laughing, mamie? What's wrong with her? Shh, Mimi says. She has been through so much, sometimes people break down for a minute. She will come back to herself, me. Oh. He watches on and walks to the trunk of his car and opens it. Lydia grips Luca's neck and steps in and takes two steps back, but when the man reaches the trunk, he retrieves only a gallon jug of water. He sets it on the side of the road. Listen, I'll leave this here for you, he says. I might have. He interrupts himself and turns back into the truck. I thought I had some cookies there too, but my son must have eaten them. I'll leave the water. He's holding his keys in his hand, and Luca can hear them clink against one another. But if you have any need of medical attention, I may be able to help. If you are hungry, I can get you some food. Lydia peers through the darkness at the sisters off the side of the road. Her eyes have adjusted to the light so she can make out their faces, but can't read their expressions. How far is the town? Soldat asks. Not far, the doctor says. Another 2 or 3 miles. A half hour's walk will get you to the edges of the city. What city is it? This is Luca. The word city has excited him as it indicates a place larger than he expected. Novo Lato, the doctor says, about 20 miles of Culiacan. Luca closes his eyes to look at the map in his mind. Now he can see Novo Lato. There's a small dot next to Culiacan, large dot, but he hasn't stored any information about this place. 20 miles, Lydia thinks. How is God's name will we get back to the train? The sisters are in no condition to walk much farther. Are there migrant services? No, Novo Lato, Lydia asks. No, the man says. I don't think so, but there's a church. They always help. What about in Culiacan? Are there migrant services there? Maybe, I'm not sure. Lydia allows a big gust of breath to billow out of her. The surge of stunned gratitude she expected when all four of them emerged from that warehouse alive and together is still with her, but it's beginning to fade behind exhaustion and lingering fear. Are you hungry? The man asks. Yes, Lucas says. Do you want a ride? Lydia looks to the sisters. Nope, Solda says. Lydia's own disappointment, her eagerness to thrust this man surprises her, but she wants to trace evidence of goodness in the world. She needs a glimmer. She can only see the outline of the man's body ahead, it lit by the peripheral glow of his car, the headlights pointing the opposite direction behind him. Thank you anyway, Lydia says. She bends a few steps toward him and looks across ahead. The Jaguar sits near the back bumper close to the man's feet. Luca pries the cap off the jug and lifts it, but it's too heavy for him and it sloshes awkwardly. The man helps. He holds the jug steadily while Luca drinks and drinks. Luca turns his face away to breathe before going back for another long drink. Lydia stands beside him and waits for him to finish. She can hear the sisters approaching behind her, but they hang back in the shadows. Listen, I don't want to press you, the doctor says, but it's not safe for you to be out on this road at night. There's a lot of activity in this area. There have been some terrible noise stories. Maybe you already know. Soledad starts again, but this time it's a solitary sound. She can no longer locate what was funny about it before. Concern creases the doctor's face. A mini flashlight dangles from his keychain, and this he clicks on. He turns a small beam toward the girl's legs to confirm what he thought he could see or smell. There is, in the dark, there's a secret amount of blood, and not only are Rebecca's jeans, Lydia can see now. Soledad are covered as well, and the blood isn't dry. Luca is still drinking. The doctor looks off the flashlight. Please, he says, won't you let me help you? Soledad crosses her arms. Rebecca makes her jaw into the shape of a square. It's Luca who speaks up. How do we know you're really a doctor? Ah, the man puts a finger in the air, then retrieves a wallet from his back pocket. There's an identification card there. The man's picture, it says, Dr. Ricardo Montananera Alcon. Luca breathes on it before handing it back. That doesn't prove anything, Soledad observed. You can be a doctor and still be a narco, too. You can be a doctor, a teacher, a priest. You can be a federal police officer and still murder people. The doctor nods, slipping the wallet back into the pocket of his jeans. It's true, he concedes. And why do you want to help us anyway, Soledad asks. The man touches a gold crucifix around his neck. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. Lydia automatic busts herself. A stranger and you welcomed me. She completes the line of scripture, passing the water jug to Rebecca, who drinks only a little before passing it to Soledad. We should go with him, Luca declares. The man lets Soledad scroll through his phone first. He shows her his Facebook page, photographs of his wife and children. She's so hungry, so depleted, she relents. The doctor wants to take them to his clinic, but they refuse, so he drives them into the city to a poorly whitewashed two-story building instead, with a shop on the bottom floor and bars on the windows above. Large letters proclaim the building to be the Techno Rojo Hotel. The shop beneath has a red awning and an open air counter where two young women wear smock aprons and the eye approaching patrons with considerable suspicion. Behind them are shiny tinfoil snacks and bottled soft drinks and neon colors. There's also a grill, the aroma of cooking meat, and the shell sound of a cheap radio playing musica norteña, heavy on the accordion. The doctor buys them food and pays for their room. If you want to ride to Culiacan tomorrow, I can come back in the morning. he says, and then he's gone before they even have time to thank him. After they've eaten and locked themselves inside their tiny room, after they've managed to move the wide, heavy nightstand across the carpet and wedge it beneath the doorknob for extra security, Lydia collects everyone's pants. The room does not have a bathroom, but there is, oddly, a toilet in one corner and a yellow sink beside it. The water that emerges from the faucet of that sink is the color of sand, but Lydia doesn't mind because the discolorated serves to camouflage the colors she has to wash out those jeans, Lucas, Rebecca's, and Soledad's. She uses a cracked bar of soap in the dish, and she scrubs and scrubs until finally the water she wrings from the denim returns to its original murky dun color. By the time she's finished, Lucas snoring softly at one of the room's two single beds, and the sisters, too, are already asleep, curled up together. Soledad cradles her sister's hand in her arms, and her hair is fanned out in one twisted black wave across their shared pillow. Lydia rummages through her pack for her toothbrush and rations a smear of paste onto the bristles. She considers the brown water from the tap before sticking the toothbrush under there and wetting it. At home, there was a whole routine before she got to bed. It could take 20 minutes some nights. Cold cream, toner, moisturizer, floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, lip balm, some nice tweezers too, or clippers, or nail files. Of course, the occasional exfoliant or mask and cream. Fluffy socks of her feet were chilly. Sebastian would whisper a call from the bedroom, trying not to wake Luca in his impatience. Madre de Dios. Wife, the Eiffel Tower was built faster, but when she was finished, he'd always fold back the covers and invite her in. He draped them over her when she was settled, along with the top half of himself. His breath was clean when he kissed her. Lydia voiced her reflection in the harsh yellow light of the rusty mirror. She spits into the sink and rinses her mouth. She splashes murky water over her face and neck and dries herself off with her shirt she wore for the last 2 days. When she finally slips into bed beside Luca, before she can even evoke her don't think mantra, exhausting the sense like an anesthesia and blots out everything else, they sleep. Some hours later, and well before dawn, Rebecca wakens Lydia from a black sleep. It's Soledad, Rebecca whispers to Lydia. Something's wrong with her. Lydia disentangles herself from Luca, who smacks his lips with his sleep, and then rolls tighter into a ball facing the wall. A good deal of light comes in through the room's only window, which has an insufficient curtain and is positioned beneath an oversized street lamp. Lydia moves to the other twin bed, where Soledad sits walking over her legs and clutching her stomach. Soledad, are you okay? She clutches her jaw and rocks her body forward. Just bad cramps. Lydia looks up at Rebecca, whose face is a cloud of worry. Just sit with Luca, Lydia says. Make sure he stays asleep. Rebecca sits at the foot of Luca's bed. Can you stand, Lydia asks. Soledad gathers strength and then rocks herself onto her feet. There's a dark stain on the mattress beneath her and the mineral scent of blood. Lydia grips her under the elbow and steers her around the bed toward the corner of the room where the plumbing is. She positions a flimsy curtain to give Soledad as much privacy as possible while she miscarries her baby. Cut to his word, the doctor returns in the morning and drives into Culiacan. The girl's jeans are still damp and stiff and Lydia's scrubby, but they wear them anyway, and the sun isn't long drying them. It eats some moisture from the clothes and their hair and skin. Rebecca moves a little easier and Soledad was a little more difficult than yesterday. Lydia wants to buy a pack of sanitary napkins for Soledad, but they're expensive, so she puts her embarrassment away and asks the doctor, who, being a doctor, thinks nothing of her request and quiets without hesitation. He also buys a breakfast and a tube of soap screen, which he urges them to use, and for Luca, a comic book. When he takes his leave, he does so abruptly to release them from the effort of gratitude. Lydia cannot wait to get back on the train and get away from the nightmarish memory of this place. To be traveling north at high speed, she's terrified as they walk the tracks to the city that they will be spotted, that the guard from yesterday will be out driving to work. Do these men commute to work? Is that what they call it? Do they kiss their wives and children goodbye each morning and then climb into their family's sedan and set out for a day of raping and extortion and then return home exhausted the evening and hungry for their pot roast? and he'll see her. He'll see her, the four of them walking along, walking north along tracks, and the information will snap into place. He'll remember her face smiling beside Javier in that picture. She pushes Luca gently in the back, ushers him into a faster pace. They cross over a muddy river on a skeletal railway bridge and discover a train yard where the tracks are lined on one side with giant boulders. A few clusters of migrants wait there, surrounded by the dirty colors of litter and debris, mud and weeds. There's a boy among them, slightly older than Luca, but certainly younger than Rebecca. He stands while the other migrants sit hunching their shoulders against him. His eyes are unfocused and his posture is the shape of a question mark. His hands float unsteadily in front of him, and he sways strangely on his curved legs. Bimby, what's wrong with him? Luca asks. He's the most disturbing child Luca has ever seen. He seems unaware of them, unaware of anything. Bimby shakes her head, but so loud for the one-word answer. Drogas. They move quickly past the boy, away from the cluster of migrants. He seems to be orbiting. In fact, they are nearly ready to quit the railway yard altogether when three well-dressed young women appear at the crossing ahead on the track. They wave their arms overhead and call out, Hermanos, tenemos comida. The men stand up from their clusters, pat the dust from their jeans, and gather for the offer of food. One of the three women reads loudly from the Bible, while the other two hand out tamales and atole. Luca's not hungry because, thanks to the doctor, they already had breakfast, but he's learned never to turn down a gift of calories. They eat gratefully, and when the women begin packing up their pots and gathering the spent roughage, Lydia wonders if they should leave this place too. It feels squalid and dangerous, but there's a rumor that one of the trains parked here is being loaded, that soon it will journey north. Men are already climbing ladders and spreading their pack on top of the train. The railway workers watch and make no move to stop them. It seems so senseless and arbitrary the way the government clears migrants from the trains of some places, spending millions of pesos and does to build those track fences in Oaxaca and Chiapas and Mexico State, all while turning a blind eye at other locations. There's even a policia municipal parked just there on the corner watching the migrants board. He sips coffee from a paper cup. It feels almost like a trap, but Lydia's too grateful to flex her suspicions. The sister's bodies are battered and weakened, especially sawdust from the miscarriage. Being able to board while the train is stopped feels like luck, so they climb up gingerly, and Lydia can still get a whiff of blood from Soledad from the ladder above her. They move back along the top of the train until they come to a car where there's room for all four of them to be comfortable just as they're sitting down. Just as Lydia is pulling the canvas belt from her pack, a little girl peeks her head up over the edge of the train car. She climbs up quickly and approaches Soledad without hesitation. The girl is younger than Luca, perhaps 6 years old, and she's alone. Her black hair is cut short and shiny, and she wears jeans and brown leather boots. She hunkers down very close to Soledad, who's startled by the girl's boldness, the intensity of her posture. She speaks rapidly, her upturned face very close to Soledad's. Soledad leans away from her. Do you need work? The girl asks quickly. Mi tia has a restaurant here, and she needs a waitress. Do you want a job? The girl puts her hand in Soledad's arm and tugs at her. Come on, quick, come on with me. I'll show you the place. She pulls Soledad's elbow, and Soledad is so taken aback that she nearly rises to follow the child. She knows she shouldn't, that the girl is presumptuous, almost bullying, but there's a conflict between Soledad's mind and her body, because her mind knows to mistrust this pushy little girl. But her body is biologically susceptible to the child's cuteness, to the beautiful innocence of her young face. Soledad feels momentarily distended between those two truths, but the spell is quickly broken because El Policia Municipal has gotten out of his car now and is standing in a patch of mud beneath the train, still carrying his paper cup of coffee. He yells up to the little girl, Ximenita, leave those people alone. Get down from there. The little girl steps her head in his direction and bolts. She drops Soledad's arm and flings herself over the edge of the freight car and back down the ladder. She reappears a moment later in the distance, dashing away from the boldness of debris. Now, Policia calls after her. Tell your papi I said no victims for you today. Soledad is eager for the hiss of the disengaged brakes and the rumble of a locomotive. When at last they begin to move, instead of happiness or relief, they're all They all feel a tentative miniature suspension of dread. As they travel, Luca pays attention to the sign so he can check out familiar place stamps on his mind map or add new dots for unfamiliar ones. Guamuchil, Pamoa, Los Mochis, check, check, check. Roughly 3 hours after pulling out of Culiacan in the middle of nowhere, they come to a place where other tracks meet the ones they're traveling on, and then there are more and more tracks until the rails are at least a dozen wide, and when the train slows down, Luca can see there are many migrants gathered here waiting again. No fence, no policias, nothing at all to prevent the whole crowd of them from boarding. La bestia. The train stops and easily 100 men get on while the train sits idling. But then the locomotive cuts its engine and its workers disembark and scatter to cars parked in a nearby lot. And everyone atop the train groans and curses. La bestia doesn't move again for 3 nights. Thank you for listening to this chapter. Have a good week and stay safe. Thank you.